You're listening to Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy.
Andrew Philip Smith, welcome to Sphinx Radio.
Oh, thanks. Good.
You are one of the foremost authorities on Gnosticism in the world, and I've heard of you through your publishing house, the Bardic Press, which is very well known over here in the United States. You are the author of a current book called The Gnostics: History, Tradition, Scriptures, Influence, and that's put out by Watkins Books. For people that don't know, Watkins Books is a bookstore and publishing house in central London that has been selling paranormal, esoteric, and occult history books for over 100 years, and it's a very prestigious press to be involved with. Donald Weiser used to own it, who does Weiser Books. And so, Andrew, we can get this book at Watkins Bookshop on their line. And is there any web page you would like to give out concerning your work?
Well, my publishing website is Bardic Press. That's bardic-press.com. And then the book should be available to all good bookstores in the USA. It's had very good coverage over here in the UK and Ireland. And also, of course, on all the online sellers will be stocking it as well.
Very good. So they could get it on Amazon as well. I had checked earlier. So you can get it on Amazon, if nowhere else. Just do a Google search for it, and it will come up. So, Andrew, tell us, who were the Gnostics? You hear a lot about them, especially with the rise of the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown and Ron Howard's big film. And there's been a huge, huge rise in interest in the Gnostics and Gnosticism. And your book seems to be a really great thumbnail sketch of this movement. Tell us a bit about your book and the Gnostics, please.
Well, the Gnostics were a variety of Christian-related sects from the early centuries AD who stressed gnosis rather than faith. And gnosis is comes from a Greek word meaning knowledge, and it means a kind of direct experiential knowledge. Direct knowledge of spirituality of God, as opposed to faith-based spirituality. The Gnostics wanted to experience God. It wasn't enough for them to just take it on faith that somebody else had experienced something, or somebody else had risen from the dead. They wanted direct experience, and it seems that they got it. And although we tend to think of them, at least in popular cultures, as sort of a monolithic, heretical group, there's actually an amazing variety of Gnostic groups. There's no central authority that they bowed to. And in the myths and scriptures and dialogues and collections of sayings that they produced, they keep experimenting. There's a large creative element in what they're doing, as opposed to mainstream Christianity, which became more and more orthodox and exclusive as time went on. And in my book, it's an introduction to the Gnostics and Gnosticism, and I really split it into two halves. The first half looks at the ancient Gnostics, the sects particularly known as Valentinians and Sethians, and I tried to really, as far as I could do so in an introduction, to go into depth, to look at actually what their teachings were, to look at the myths of the Gnostics, the way that they interpreted the Bible, things that they actually did. They carried out all these sacramental practices, baptism, they also had their own version of the Eucharist, rite of the bridal chamber, redemption, these sorts of things. And also a look at how they viewed human beings. They had a kind of psychology or anthropology of human beings, which split us into body, soul, and spirit. And their myths, which involve the fall of Sophia, this divine figure, also parallel what happens within the human psyche. So in the Gnostics we have a non-authoritarian branch of Christianity, although they weren't necessarily wholly Christian. They were, you know, possibly they developed in tandem with Christianity. And then in the second part of the book I look at the successor movements. Although the Gnostics suffered greatly when Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire in the 3rd century, and eventually they were sort of, it wasn't so much a case of violent persecution, but there was more of a stranglehold put on them, and they eventually faded out. But we do see these later groups which have much in common with Gnosticism, the Paulicians in the late 1st millennium, then the Bogomils and the Cathars, who are well known. Who also, in their various ways, stress personal responsibility. And they also use the very similar myths to the ancient Gnostics. And then there's also a sect called the Mandaeans, who've been in the news lately, who are actually a survival, probably since the 1st century, and represent a separate strain of Gnosticism, which has survived down the centuries. And they survived in Iraq and Iran for a long time, and actually didn't do too badly under the regime of Saddam Hussein for various political reasons. But when all that broke up, they were suffering from persecution by other Muslim groups in the areas in which they live, and there's been a lot of emigration of the Mandaeans in the past 10, 20 years, and their whole way of life is under danger at the moment.
Wow, that's terrible. So Gnosticism never technically died out altogether. It survived in direct strains and indirect strains through these different medieval Christian groups you've mentioned earlier. Now, just on to a specific question, what was a general Gnostic view of who and what Jesus Christ was? Because people are really interested, as I said earlier, the Da Vinci Code. Could you give us a breakdown of what the Gnostic view of Jesus was?
Well, actually, it's quite different to the Da Vinci Code. The Da Vinci Code draws on, you know, the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, and that whole recent tradition of investigation. And in fact, the Gospel of Philip, which is a genuine Gnostic Gospel, part of the Nag Hammadi find, which was discovered in 1945, is quoted in the Da Vinci Code because it mentions that Mary Magdalene was the consort of Jesus. But in fact, the Gnostics really didn't look on Jesus so much as a historical authority figure in that way. As I said, the Gnostics didn't agree with each other. They tended to come up with new ideas, new ways of looking at things, rather than sticking to some central dogma. And in fact, one distinctively Gnostic view of Jesus is that he didn't necessarily come in the body. There's what's called a Docetism, coming from a Greek word meaning just appearance. That Jesus only appeared to be in the body, and in fact he didn't die on the cross for that very reason.
So he was more of a spirit being than a physical being, so to speak.
That's right, yes. And he sometimes even, in the Gnostic mythology, has something called the Pleroma, which means formless, which is this divine realm full of spiritual beings. And Jesus, and sometimes Christ as a separate being, often listed among the eons, the beings that inhabited the Pleroma. And then when Gnostic texts do refer to Jesus, often it's after the resurrection. There's a tradition that Jesus taught the disciples after he'd been resurrected, and the Gnostic knowledge comes from that tradition rather than the tradition of what Jesus taught in his lifetime. So the Gnostic views are really quite different to what you find in the Da Vinci Code.
Right, I just wanted to really point that out, because that Gospel of Philip is like overused by Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and Da Vinci Code advocates, and I just wanted someone who really knew what they were talking about, like yourself, to correct, you know, Jesus probably didn't have any children in the Gnostic view because he was this kind of spirit being, if that's,
yeah, yeah,
you know, roughly.
It never mentions him having children. But what I would add, though, is although a lot has been made of the speculation that Mary Magdalene was married to Jesus, what you do find in Gnostic texts is that she was an important disciple of Jesus, and she's often in opposition to the male disciples, such as Peter, or more often, actually, Peter is telling Mary to go away. You know, there's a famous part in the Gospel of Thomas where Peter says to Jesus, tell Mary to go away because women are not worthy of the life. And Jesus replies that any woman who makes herself male, but by which I think he means who can be in the spirit, which is allegorically referred to as male, can be in the kingdom. And in the Gospel of Mary, Mary has secret information that Jesus has taught her, and the male disciples don't believe it, and they're criticizing her. So I think Elaine Pagels said that what the recent interest in Mary Magdalene has done is to turn her into Mrs. Jesus, whereas in fact in the Gnostic texts she's an important disciple in her own right, regardless of any, you know, any relationship to Jesus otherwise.
Whether there was or wasn't, she's in the Gnostic tradition, she certainly was very, very important, and I don't take that away. It's just, I guess the Da Vinci Code people hang a lot of theory on very little information. So, I mean, most people who even talk about it don't even realize what the Gnostic view of Jesus was. So, that, you know, that's an important issue to hash out. Now, do you give the complete history of the persecution of the Gnostics? Because, as you mentioned earlier, they suffered horribly roughly after 325 AD. Do you get into that quite a bit?
We actually don't know all that much about it. I can only think of one example where a Valentinian Gnostic church was destroyed by Orthodox Christians. It really, as far as we can see, it just disappears. It's actually in the second and third century we have these heresy hunting church fathers like Irenaeus, Hippolytus, Tertullian, who are attacking the Gnostics in their writings. But especially with the case of Irenaeus, that was before the church really had any temporal power. So we actually don't know how they disappeared, really. And like I said, I think it's more of a stranglehold. You know, and perhaps, I mean, we do know that Christians violently persecuted other groups. There's that famous example of Hypatia, who was a Neoplatonist philosopher, a female, who was said to have been skinned by Christians using oyster shells that skinned her alive. She was a Neoplatonist philosopher. So there probably was some violence, but unfortunately we don't know all that much in terms of the real details.
What documentary evidence do we have for the emergence of Gnostic ideas, say, as we move into the early Middle Ages, into the Middle Ages? Is there one group that stands out that you would consider a Gnostic carryover?
Well, the Cathars, I think you'd have to include as the most Gnostic Christian group of the Middle Ages. But they actually, they were connected to the Bogomils, who actually preceded them, and they were, you know, the Cathars were in the south of France and in Italy as well, and the Bogomils were further east in parts of the former Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, that kind of area, the Balkans. And the Cathars, I mean, that's another tragedy, because what's most famous about the Cathars is the way that they were destroyed at the Albigensian Crusade. The Pope, it's a long and complex story, but the Cathars, they also sometimes saw Jesus as a docetic being, you know, as a spiritual being. And they had this doctrine of personal responsibility using a rite known as the consolamentum, which comes from the same word as console. So this was an initiation rite. There were different degrees of Cathars, and if you became the Cathar Perfect, which is sort of the inner circle of the Cathars, you underwent a rite known as the consolamentum, which involved the Gospel of John, which is the only gospel that they really used, being placed on the head, and there were certain requirements placed on the Cathar Perfect who underwent that ceremony. And it was completely a question of personal responsibility. That Cathar was responsible for everybody else that he initiated. And if he didn't keep to the strictures and the restrictions that he had vowed to keep in that rite, then everybody who he had initiated would have lost their standing. So this created a kind of chain of responsibility, which is very different to the sort of authoritarian approach that dominated the medieval Catholic Church at the time. But the Cathars really were wiped out in a series of massacres which were had the only purpose of maintaining the Catholic Church as the Orthodox and dominant church in the area. But there were also political reasons in the area of the south of France. And apart from the Mandeans, it's actually with the Cathars where the historical chain of Gnosticism ends. I mean, there are arguments that perhaps the Knights Templars were connected with the Cathars, and then when the Templars were destroyed, perhaps they went underground. That's rather more speculative.
Is there any documentary evidence that points in that direction that you've seen?
No, there isn't. We have very little information on what happened after the Templars were destroyed. I mean, we do know that some Templar families were connected with Cathar families. We do have documentary evidence about that. But the continuation of the Templars is very speculative.
As well, yeah. They might have been absorbed into Freemasonry, and they're uncertain after that. It's very good to get these things clear, because over here in the States, you know, things even like on the History Channel or the Learning Channel spew a lot of this stuff out as if it's historical fact. And it's quite misleading, you know. The Da Vinci Code's a novel, by the way. People forget that, you know.
Well, I have nothing against romanticism, but you should be able to have both sides of the story.
Right.
I mean, you look what facts you have, what the texts really say, what we can really deduce from the documentary evidence, and then, you know, we can also have a romantic view of what happened in the past, but you should keep them separate, I think.
Oh, right, definitely so, and people should just realize that, you know, Dan Brown's book and Ron Howard's film, it's movies and it's entertaining, and as thought-provoking as it is, you really have to look at the more hard historical facts before you know, make any sort of judgment, which your work is very good at doing, Andrew. Now, could you tell us just a bit about the Delphic Press, how you came to found it? It's really, really interesting, and I'm kind of copycatting you a little bit, so that's why I'm asking. So how did you come about with this new press? Could you tell us a bit about the history of it?
Well, Bardic Press, it exists to publish things that I'm interested in, and also to republish works that have been ignored over the decades, and, you know, my interests, as well as Gnosticism, there's the Gurdjieff tradition, I like Sufi poetry. I've published a couple of translations of Hafiz and Omar Khayyam, a collection of Omar Khayyam translations. Also, Celtic mythology is another interest of mine, and I published a massive and extraordinary work on the Welsh myths, the Mabinogi, which by Will Parker, who studied at Cambridge, and that's a fascinating look at all the different levels of these ancient tales.
You're a Welshman yourself, is that correct?
That's right, yes.
I'm living
in Ireland now. I lived in California for 10 years, actually, but I'm from Wales, yeah.
Oh, very good. Wonderful that you're keeping these things going. Now, I really want to highly recommend your Sufi books, and I've even discussed your books with people like Sayyid Hussein Nasir and people in the traditionalist school. So you're very well respected for what you do. Rama Kumara Swami, a few people like that. Patrice Lode is aware of your books. So people in the traditionalist movement like your press, and we've taken note of what you've been doing, and we really, really like it, by the way, even the Celtic stuff as well.
That's great. I had no idea of that. I often feel a bit isolated in terms of feedback with these things, so if anybody likes a book, please email me and tell me.
Well, that's the problem of living in the internet world, to be honest with you. You still find yourself sitting in your bedroom in front of your computer, and you don't quite get the sort of accolades that people used to get, writers used to get, say, 20 or 30 years ago. So that's one good thing about things like Sphinx Radio, is it hooks up people from different groups, and that's the internet world. Now, what other books do you have planned after this? Are you coming out with anything new, or are you just sticking to promoting the Gnostic book for right now?
Well, actually, I didn't mention the other books I've written on Gnostic texts. I did a brief book on the Gospel of Thomas, which is out of print now. I did a whole book on the Gospel of Philip, where I do go into the vagaries of the Da Vinci Code and what the Gospel of Philip really means. Also, Gnostic Writings on the Soul, where I look at two Gnostic texts, the Exegesis on the Soul and the Hymn of the Pearl. And I also have a introduction which looks at the great variety of ideas through the centuries concerning the soul in different religious and philosophical traditions. And in the spring I have a book coming out with Quest, a Gnostic dictionary.
Wonderful. That's a Theosophical publishing house, Quest Books?
That's right, yes.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Oh, great. Go ahead, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Richard Smoley is my editor on that, and I'm just putting the finishing touches to it. So it's a thorough dictionary of Gnosticism, including just about every term you could come across in the Mag Hammadi Library, and the Cathars, the Manichaeans, a really broad investigative dictionary into Gnosticism proper. And then in the future, I'm planning a book on the Mandaeans, I'm going to be a bit more speculative in that one, and to look at their claims to survive through the centuries and actually go back to the first century to John the Baptist. They revere John the Baptist as a prophet, although not actually as their founder. There is a good case that they belong with all these other strange Baptist groups in the first century in the region of Judea. There's a biography of Rodney Collin, who was a pupil of Uspensky, that I've been working on for several years.
Fantastic. I was Jacob Needleman's teaching assistant, so I went through all of the Uspensky Gurdjieff stuff. I'm familiar with them.
Oh, great, yeah. In connection with that, I'm hoping to republish some of Araj's earlier works as well.
Oh, very good. Well, anything?
There are plenty of other things coming along, too. So.
Oh, very good. You seem to got your hands full right now. Never mind future plans, and that's wonderful. Listen, I want to give out, we're about out of time, I'm going to give out the name of the book once more, The Gnostics, History, Tradition, Scriptures, Influence, and that is published by Watkins Book, and the name of the author is Andrew Philip Smith. Andrew, I'd like to thank you very much for being on Sphinx Radio, and we'll have you on again sometime, especially when your Gnostic dictionary comes out. By the way, The guy editing that was the editor of Gnosis magazine for many years and worked with Gnosis out in San Francisco. So that if he's putting his name behind it, that's a really big book. And I congratulate you, and thanks again for being on Sphinx Radio.
Thanks, I've enjoyed it.